of the budget for these things comes from the state and federal government. Well, and then, you know, there is some issues with, like, the bus system not actually having, you know, not actually being a real high priority for all the various officials, you know, in the local governments of various sorts, as far as actually figuring out what kind of community-based consensus we can come to about where they can actually locate, you know, some equivalent of the metro base. Because as it is, they have to spend a lot of money doing workarounds for the fact they don't have an adequate facility.
Well, you know, I just noticed
that's $2 million a year that goes to workarounds rather than allowing people to actually use the bus system.
Well, I guess I'm not too conversant with the Transportation Commission. I guess it's the County Transportation Commission that does that. I guess I just know that you know, I tend to have knee-jerk reactions to people like Rotkin who are on that board, and I've heard, you know, sort of secondary criticisms of the board. Plus, I know that I heard from the report from Jeffrey Gale is there are many people opposed to the cuts who came to the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
They were essentially ignored. I wasn't at the meeting. I don't know if his report is accurate,
mm-hmm.
so I can't really say. But I also know that in terms of how the city budget works, the police department seems to be inviolate, has for years. And I'm
right.
wondering if there isn't a similar choice made with respect to buses as well in terms of putting money there or putting money into, I don't know, more frills for Mark Tracy's deputy, or, you know, more equipment.
Well, I think, you know, if you actually listen to the whole dialogue that went on around after, you know, the utility tax was repealed in the county level, it seemed pretty clear that the sheriff was confident that his portion of the budget would not be tremendously negatively impacted, that he would take some level of cuts, but, you know, nothing in proportion to what the rest of the county has had to take.
Well, also, the transportation has been cut back again and again prior to these utility cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It seems to me like it's not simply a function of the, you know, latest overspending or the, you know, the economy downturn. That there's a series of priorities in place which gives the short end of the stick to poor people who need to ride buses. Am I wrong about that? I mean, I admit to ignorance.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on that budget either, but I am pretty confident that the vast majority of the funding for all this stuff isn't really local. It's state and federal. And so, you know, to whatever extent that's the case, you know, cutbacks in these areas are, you know, symptoms of a much larger problem.
Now, we're just sort of, Huff is addressing Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
We're both members of that group, is
mm-hmm.
addressing the small problem of trying to stop the staff. It isn't even the city council. It's the staff of the city, headed by Dick Wilson, and actually Martine Bernal, I think, is probably the lead player here, in removing this planter space seating area in front of Costa Brava, Pacific Trading Company, and Rosie McCann's.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, I'd had a conversation with Martine on Friday, and he told me that this was all going to be happening on June 6th. But some of us were saying, how can we stop this? We thought, well, maybe we should call Parks and Rec commissioners, maybe we should call downtown commissioners, because Parks and Rec, as you know, has asked that there be more benches.
Right.
And that the mandate given that the community gave the city government to proceed to put benches up and down the mall after Vision Santa Cruz and the earthquake reconstruction is being violated privately by Parks and Rec at the behest of private merchants and perhaps the police. And I don't know what other, maybe Public Works. And Parks and Rec said, put this shit on hold. Let's find out what's going on with the benches. Don't remove benches out of public process. They sent such a recommendation to City Council over 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Riley, in spite of the mandate which has been in effect for 2 years, that you either respond to a commission report by putting it on the agenda or sending it back and saying, this is why I wrote, has done neither of those things about that, you know, keep expand the benches or deal with the bench problem.
Well, did they ever actually put the Citizens Police Review Board?
No, that was not, that's another thing the argument could be made, the staff member who was a former deputy did not forward it, Jenny didn't forward it, because she said she couldn't get enough input from Mark Halfman. All she had to do was forward the resolution. But she insisted on getting pros and cons. Actually, I sat down and worked out with her a list of pros and cons and said, you know, can you run this by him and see if this is okay? And she said she would, but she never did.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she's a deliberately... I don't know what her... I really can't say what she did there. But what... you know, in other words, it didn't reach the mayor's office. So maybe... Mm. Or if it did reach the mayor's office, it did so...
Well, I mean, certainly the mayor is fully aware that the resolution was passed.
Yes. That was a resolution about selective enforcement.
Right. Which is all part of this... You know,
the same ball of poop.
This complex of issues around downtown, which are, you know, when you sort through everything, what it comes down to is that downtown is not being managed democratically and effectively. That they're continually implementing ad hoc solutions to whatever issues develop. And they're moving, you know, to whatever extent that there's an actual problem with behavior, they're not addressing the actual problems with behavior. They're simply displacing the people from one place to the next, each one less appropriate to any form of public, gathering.
Not even that. The selective enforcement doesn't simply displace people, it criminalizes them.
Right.
It
produces criminal, it produces records, it produces warrants that get people into this endless cycle of, you know...
The intention of these efforts...
To drive people out of the downtown.
Is to make people so afraid that they will do whatever the police tell them to do, so that the police can clear up problems by fiat, by decree, and on an ad hoc basis.
Right, but we know that...
That's fascism.
Yes.
That's police state stuff. You don't... People, that's not how problems are cleared up. They're resolved in a legislative process.
That's
not what's happening.
Yeah, all it does is it damages, you know, the individuals that get targeted and harassed by the police, and it doesn't actually address any of the issues, because there's always more youth being produced for some strange reason, and thanks to our economy, there's always more homeless people, and, there are other communities that have addressed these issues in productive, democratic ways that actually deal with whatever conflicts of behavior or usage exist.
What communities are you thinking of?
Well, I'm thinking of specifically in this context. Now, it hasn't been perfect, but in Santa Monica, they have tons of sitting space. They have benches, and they have planters, and... What they've done is they've created a downtown plaza, and the people gather downtown, but they gather away from the storefronts and away from the flow of foot traffic. So there's this broad avenue where people can actually participate, where musicians can actually have crowds around them, substantial crowds. I've walked through downtown Santa Monica, and there's been all sorts of musicians all up and down the mall, and they've had crowds of like 20, 40, 50 people around them. And it doesn't actually block the flow of traffic, and it doesn't actually, like, pose an issue for the merchants, you know, who need people to get in and out of their storefronts. And it's actually, what they're doing in Santa Monica now is they're actually putting in more benches and more spaces for people to sit down, because the merchants want them, because when this works, this benefits everyone. It draws more people because there's color and life and vividness to... The downtown, you know that like when the police actually are able to drive everyone out, it kills downtowns.
Yeah,
sterilizes them. It produces them nothing. Creates a place that nobody has any real desire to go to.
Yeah, I think there's much better kind of interaction on days like during the Wine and Cheese Festival, provided the police aren't driving away the street musicians or arresting people for doing brown bag, which is what they were doing. You can get tanked up if you want by buying the merchant booze, but if you carry your own bottle, they'll carry you away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it is true also in Santa Monica, there's all kinds of nasty shit going down around the feeding situation, where they're trying to destroy the feeding programs, and of course, sleeping ban problems are arising down there too, where reactionaries are fighting to, or actually have succeeded, in a, you know, an institutionalized system of harassment of poor people and homeless people who don't sleep at night. But I was unaware of that situation with the benches. I'm glad to hear it. I was going to tell you that another thing that I heard from Assistant City Manager Martine Bernal 2 days ago was we were wondering how can we lobby to stop this bench, this destruction of the planet. It's going to cost, according to Martine, $12,000.
Okay, that's an even bigger number than the $7,000 that was cited before.
Yeah, it was $12,000. It might even be more. It might be $15,000. I think it's at least $12,000. And he said, this is to remove the rust on the fence. You know, yeah, thank you very much. And I said, you're going to do this with the other planters? They were all made at the same time, and he was kind of ambiguous on that reply.
Well, you know, you might actually be giving them ideas. They might decide that they'll just rip them all out just to make sure that, you know, the blatant hypocrisy of this is not glaringly obvious.
Well, it's obvious, but this is the next thing, Martine said. That Huff was asking, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom members were asking, how can the community oppose this? And we thought first, well, let's email these Parks and Rec Commission members, and let's email the Downtown Commission members. We contacted the city clerk, and she wouldn't give us the emails of those people. She said, they are private citizens. We can't give you their emails. And what we can do is give you the staff's email, and the staff will forward it. And, of course, I was outraged to hear this, because staff, in many cases, is at odds with these commissions. The commissions are sort of the last gasp of democracy in Santa Cruz. They are fighting to try to get public input around issues. The public is concerned about whether it's restoring a fair deal for poor musicians, street musicians, poor people downtown, whether it's restoring benches and seating space, whether it's stopping selective enforcement generally and racial profiling. And the city council wants to do absolutely nothing about these issues. It wants to ignore them completely. But they get put on the spot when the commission starts saying something. But if the staff of these commissions is not interested in addressing these issues, they have to be dragged kicking and screaming forward on these issues. So why should the staff be given first read on all emails that come in to commission members? I asked this of Martine and said, you know, if you want, there should be access to these commission members. In fact, seems like there may be even a legal requirement. He said, no, there's not. And I don't know that there is, but it's just an example of the secretive nature. So, but the thing I learned that was more interesting than all of this, although these are interesting facts, that they're keeping us from, you know, engaging in direct communication with our commissioners, I suggest to them, I would say, look, if commissioners send out an email to all the commissioners, Martine, and say, if you don't want your email address given out, send us a note.
Well, you know what they could do that would be even more simple than that is just give every commissioner a official city email address. And so their private email addresses wouldn't be revealed, and people could communicate with them on matters of public business through that address, and that could be published, and, you know, there wouldn't be any issue.
Would that be expensive?
No.
How much would it cost to do for, let's say, 100 people if you consider all the commission members? Probably more than that.
Well, it would probably take a competent, you know, system administrator, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 hours. Or less.
So the total cost would be?
I don't know. They probably get paid like $50 an hour, $150.
So it'd be under $1,000.
Oh, far under $1,000.
Under $500.
Yeah, I'd be confident it'd be under $500. I mean, I'm not sure how you'd manage how you'd cost out everything, but well, yeah, it would be trivial.
Well, what I learned. And I encourage people to call the City Council, 420-5022 is the mayor's number, if you're interested, 420-5022. Is that you don't, Martinez said, the only reason that they are proceeding with this planter deal, this planter fencing, is because they have heard nothing from any City Council member opposing it. And I said, wait a minute, you haven't even told the City Council, oh, they know about it. I said, you do, well, and they didn't write us back anything. We heard nothing. Council members have never attended our meetings. They've said nothing to us about this. And I said, so if one council member emails or phones you and says, hold this project, I want to talk about it, you'll hold it. He said, yes. So what that means is if this community can persuade one city council person to say, it's not such a hot idea to remove seating space in front of Costa Brava without a public process, without alternate seating, without any real understanding what the problems are there in terms of any documented discussion,
right,
without any public hearing on the issue, they will stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion to people is that today you go to the phone and you phone the city council member of your choice. And the way you do that is you dial 420-5020, and they'll give you a choice of council members to talk to. Or you can call the mayor at 420-5022 and just say, I want you to contact Martine Bernal, assistant city manager, and tell him, put a hold on this project, at least until the community can talk about it. What do you think of that idea?
I think that it makes a lot of sense. Of course, I have some level of skepticism about whether or not it will actually result in the city council member, you know, making that call, but it could. And, I also find it interesting that, like, basically speaking, that actions like this can take place without any actual substantive documentation being presented to the public about what's going on. It's just like, by declaration, this is a problem. There are problems here, you know, therefore we must do something about it. Okay, well, what are the problems? How many times have these things happened? What can you document?
You know, Martine Brunel, I said to Martine, I want to get a copy from you of every email from every merchant, and every time, I want to get minutes of every meeting where this is discussed. So we don't keep minutes of our meetings. I said, I want every written document. We have no written documents. I said, well, what about the number of complaints that have come in? I said, well, I can look for that, but that's a very time-consuming and costly job. He didn't say costly. He said time-consuming, actually.
Right.
And so I said, he's going to look through the, he's already 6 months late in looking through emails, or 5 months late, 4 months, actually, 4 months late, looking for emails around the issue of Citizens Police Review Board and the killing of the Police Review Board, and also the latest on the downtown ordinances. He was supposed to respond. He responded within 10 days, he said, by saying it'll take more time. But I think he's way beyond his time and spending four and not having a...
Go to the email client, type in search messages, type in Costa Brava, and just walk away from your computer, and when you come back, there will be a list of all the emails that have the word Costa Brava in them.
Well, that's what I thought. I told him. He said, oh, no, they all have to be looked at by hand. You have to go over each one of them and look at each one of them. Maybe what we need is a computer expert like yourself, Thomas, to show up, maybe in a large outfit. You could come disguised as a computer, maybe make your way into City Hall, maybe be treated in a friendlier fashion in that way. I don't know. We're talking with Thomas Levitt, who is a Green Party activist. Anything doing in the Green Party these days we should know about, by the way?
The Green Party has been continuing to meet. I haven't made, I think, the last two meetings. They're passing various resolutions, and they're busy tabling and doing other things.
Anything have to do with any local issues that might impact our dear Green Party council member, Tim Fitzmaurice, who's well known for his anti-homeless activity?
I'm not aware of anything, actually happening on a local level.
So the Greens are sort of repressive, locally liberated, at a statewide and national level, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, Tim Fitzmaurice didn't get the endorsement the last time around, and I did.
Yeah, that's nice. But what else has the Green Party done without you dragging them, kicking and screaming into the 21st century?
Well, you know, it all depends on who shows up and how much energy they put into it. And, on a personal basis, you know, my energy is, I prefer that my energy go into something that actually has a tangible result right now.
I think you're saying also that, I mean, you know, you have gotten some symbolic results. You have gotten the Green Party, some Green Party members to pass resolutions that they wouldn't support the People's Peace Vigil, as I call it. The vigil against two wars.
Yes, that was unfortunate. And
the signs were too ragged for Paul Franklin, and what a pity that was.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that, you know, you've been struggling, as we heard earlier in this phone conversation, with fighting to retain your very property, retain your domain name against
mm-hmm.
Michael Savage. And you can't be expected to be, you know, if the Green Party is simply... you know, only responds when you come in there and create a large clamor, seems to me that the core of the Green Party is pretty right-wing, if that's the way it is. And if that's the reality, I think people should know about it before they jump on board this thing, unless they're aware that if you're gonna use the Green Party, you damn well better be prepared to put in lots of energy to change its current course of conduct. Now, you probably want to respond to that, and I'll give you a moment to, but I also want to proceed to SCAN, because you've been following SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network,
mm-hmm.
a bit. And their priority is supposed to be the budget. We just had the last, I would call it, bullshit budget session from Mayor Riley. And I heard a long report I mentioned from Jim Ross, who actually went to that last she was doing hourly meetings every week on the budget.
Mm-hmm.
But the real budget discussions are happening when the Ad Hoc Advisory Budget Crisis Committee, which were closed to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see the agendas afterward, but there were no minutes taken, and the agendas never went out to the public, and members of the public were never informed about them. So can you tell us a little something about the budget crisis and SCAN's react? Is SCAN moving to do something to make sure the police don't gobble up the entire store here?
You know, I actually wasn't at the last SCAN steering committee meeting, so I'm not certain what is actually happening. What I do have to say is that, you know, fundamentally, if you actually go take a look at all of the progressive, political institutions in this town, the fact is that, you know, at this point, unfortunately, none of them can really claim to be mass movements because nobody shows up. Nobody, they leave the work, all the work and all the action to a small group of people who, you know, will always have their own particular priorities and agendas. And if people really want the progressive politics to actually happen in this town, there needs to be more than like 10 people at a Green Party meeting, which allows two people. If there's in a Green Party meeting, if something does not reach consensus, it has to pass by an 80% vote. Therefore, if only 10 people show up, 3 people can block any action. The fact is, people actually have to show up and be willing to put actual work into the organization and into making it possible for the organization to actually do other things. And, you know, bluntly, this isn't happening. So to a certain extent, the community is responsible for the fact that the political infrastructure, I mean, if 20 people listening right now showed up to each of these meetings...
Thomas, I must disagree with you. There were times 20 people did show up. There were times mm-hmm. 30 and 40 people showed up. I saw 80 and 90 and 100 people show up to the SCAN meeting that voted in favor of the rights of the Dolphin League tenants. It mm-hmm. was to no avail. And they realized, because the steering committee and Nora Hockman and Bernice Belter...
Sandy Brown
mm-hmm. sabotaged all this shit in committee and destroyed it. So my point to you is, it's all very well talked about a lot of people showing up, but that's not the problem. I mean, that's certainly a problem in any situation. You got to have people showing up. But in these particular organizations, people showing up didn't make a difference.
Then they need to create their own organizations.
They sure do.
And they need to show up at the Huff meetings.
That would be nice.
You know, there's...
But how many
people
sit through one of my Huff meetings?
I don't know. Well, you know, that... I mean...
You have been showing up at the Huff meetings because you've had all kinds of personal crises in your life, and I think that's a situation for a lot of people.
No, I think that's quite true.
And I think that a lot of people have that problem.
Yes.
And I don't know what the answer is.
I don't know what the answer is either.
Mm-hmm.
But change requires that the powers that be feel threatened, and of course they will respond in a way like with the lawsuit against me. You know, they will use the repressive powers of government and law and corporate power and economic duress and, their control over the media to, dictate the dialogue and to, create the perception that they're in the majority. And the way that, people can respond to this is by acting to show that all that's a lie.
And that's, of course, what we're trying to do on the radio show. Encourage
mm-hmm.
people to call the City Council, 420-5017.
And you can bet that if there's 30 phone calls, that some City Council member is going to think, oh, this is more than just Robert Norris again, or Thomas Levitt again, or Steve Argue again. Maybe there's a real problem here.
So start calling folks if you want to keep that... that planter available for seeding if you want to stop the gentrification. It's one step in that direction. Thomas, thank you very much for being on the air with us. Anything you want to add?
Just go to the SavageStupidity.com website, take a look at the lawsuits. I put the email address for the law firm that Savage is using on the website. You might write them a note, and, lawyers bill at like $150 an hour, so if they have to spend 10 hours reading annoyed emails from the general public, then maybe they'll think, maybe this isn't really worth what we're, you know, the hassle factor.
Or maybe they'll think, wow, more time means more money for us. Let's
That's cool. But hey, then they'll just bill the Michael Savage.
And Savage will pass it on to all the listeners and the products he sells. Well, I won't be negative.
Yes.
Do get in touch by checking the website, www.savagestupidity.com.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes.
Hey, Thomas Levitt, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
California, Small Circle of Friends. Comes now the Cannabinoids. Cannabinoids is an article, actually a column by Fred Gardner in the Anderson Valley Advertiser. And if only for this column, this is one reason the Anderson Valley Advertiser is worth buying every week, which is what I usually do. I wonder why I don't go buy something else. You can get it at the Book Loft. You can get it at the Capitola Book Cafe. I think you can get it at Bookshop Santa Cruz. It's a weekly publication that comes out of Boonville, California, of all places. It publishes Alexander Coburn, who publishes Jeffrey Sinclair, and has this great column on sort of the fight for to decriminalize, to legalize marijuana, the end of the medieval reign of terror around marijuana. And it's a column I'm going to read. This is a column from the May 21st Anderson Valley Advertiser. Three physicians and about a dozen cannabis-using patients attended the May 8th meeting of the State Medical Board's Enforcement Committee to decry investigations of doctors who have made a subspecialty of monitoring cannabis use. The board's chief investigator, David Thornton, sought to reassure the committee and the concerned citizens that his agents were not out to prosecute doctors who approve marijuana use. Thornton described one, quote, egregious example, unquote, of a physician whose, quote, medical office contained a computer, a printer, and a cash register. There were no other instruments in that office. There was very little a physician was doing medically in that office to determine whether there had been an indication for a prescription. You walked in, you paid your money, your name was put on the computer, and a letter was generated, end quote. Thornton testified that the board had conducted only 9 marijuana-related investigations since the passage of Proposition 215. 9 investigations in 6.5 years is not a lot of investigations, he said. He supervises about 100 investigators working out of 12 offices statewide. They are currently looking into about 1,500 cases. Another 400 to 500 have been forwarded to the Attorney General for possible prosecution. From the perspective of cannabis-using patients, however, the pattern seems ominous because 8 of the 9 investigated physicians are responsible for approximately half the 50,000 approvals to date in California. Most doctors are unwilling to approve the use of cannabis in treating conditions that are not life-threatening. Therefore, patients who use it to treat migraines, chronic pain, depression, etc., have obtained their approvals from a small group of doctors who have made a subspecialty of monitoring cannabis use. Several thousand California physicians have approved marijuana use, according to Cannabis Club intake records, but a large majority have done so only for a few of their patients. Of the 9 doctors who have been investigated by the board in connection with marijuana approvals, 8 fall into the subspecialist category. Stephen Bannister, Todd McAria, William I. Edelman, Marion Fry, Frank Lucido, David Bierman, Mike Alkaley, and R. Stephen Ellis. The 9th is a doctor named Robert Newport, who prescribed a drug for a family member on which the family member overdosed. Since Newport had also approved the family member's use of marijuana, Thornton lists the case as marijuana-related. Bannister, Stephen Bannister, the family practitioner from Nevada City, was one of the first cannabis subspecialists to be investigated by the board. The initial complaint against him came from a probation officer resentful that a client of his named Wesley Stockdale had a letter from Bannister entitling him to use marijuana. When the board asked to review the records, Stockdale wrote, "Not only do I find this to be a gross invasion of my privacy, wherein I also object to the subpoenaing of my records in any and every way possible, but I believe Dr. Bannister to be a man of high integrity, competence, decency, and compassion, and I believe that the review of my chosen physician to be a highly inappropriate and misguided action." Bannister agreed to a 3-year probation that enabled him to continue practicing and even to approve his patient's use of cannabis, but he had to pay a fine, attend classes at UC San Diego, and be monitored by another physician for 3 years. Bannister, like Newport, is officially on probation. The McAria and Edelman cases are officially pending with the Attorney General. Edelman, whose practice was in the Los Angeles area, received an interim suspension order last May. He can't practice until the case gets settled or heard by an administrative law judge. To say his records were inadequate would be an understatement, says Thornton. That's David Thornton, the Medical Board Enforcement Committee's chief investigator. It can be inferred that Edelman is Thornton's so-called egregious example. McAria is due to have a hearing in Oakland in September. An administrative law judge will review 17 patients' files obtained by subpoena over the objections of doctor and patients to determine whether a proper, quote, standard of care had been met. In not one of the cases did the complaint against McAria come from a patient or a caregiver or another health care worker. They were all instigated by law enforcement agents. nor did any of the complaints allege harm to a patient. David Behrman of San Diego has been under investigation since September of 2001. Possession of a letter of approval from Behrman had enabled patient X to foil a state park ranger's attempt to confiscate his marijuana. The ranger filed a complaint with the board, questioning the standard of care provided by Dr. Behrman. The board then asked Behrman to forward to patient X's records. Behrman refused, citing doctor-patient confidentiality. The board subpoenaed patient X's file. Behrman refused to provide it. The board recently threatened him with a $1,000 a day fine until he complies. Behrman, who says he takes at least an hour to conduct an initial exam, is confident that the board would call off the investigation immediately upon seeing his documentation of patient X's condition, but you know how it is. Some guys just never get over their ninth grade civics classes. You know, believe in the Constitution of all things. Three other cases are officially under investigation. The case against Frank Lucido involves a teenager whose hyperactivity disorder had been treated unsuccessfully with several pharmaceuticals, including Ritalin, Prozac, and lithium, which either didn't work or caused unacceptable side effects. Cannabis enabled the kid to attend school and get excellent grades, as well as work part-time, but a possession charge led to trouble with school administrators and law enforcement. Alkalay's case involves an 8-year-old boy whose uncontrollable, frequently violent behavior was about to result in his removal to a residential treatment center. A cannabis extract, the 20th medication the boy had been treated with, worked so well that he was able to attend public school and make friends. The problem is, Alkay wrote his initial recommendation based on a review of the records plus many hours of phone contact with the mother, supplemented by a trusted assistant's interviews with her, but no face-to-face interview with the boy. The case against Marion Fry seems analogous to the one against Macaria. Every patient I've been asked about by the medical board has passed either through the criminal justice system in either El Dorado or Sacramento County, she says, and the complaints all came from district attorneys, not the patients themselves. The board's investigation into R. Stephen Ellis, M.D., a San Francisco physician, a San Francisco physician who advertises his willingness to write medical marijuana recommendations in several newspapers, ended with a terse note last September. The Medical Board of California is closing the inquiry into the care and treatment you are providing at this time based upon the written assurances of your counsel that you have come into compliance. Ellis said, they'd had no complaints. My ads caught their attention. Medical board meetings are generally held in a featureless fluorescent conference rooms at hotels near airports. The May 8th session was at the Doubletree in Sacramento. Enforcement Committee Chair Ronald Wender, M.D., gave the members of the public 2 to 3 minutes each to express their opinions. Excerpted here are some of their heartfelt comments. Phil Denny, M.D., quote, I'm a 1976 graduate of the University of Southern California. I've practiced medicine in California successfully for 27 years. The recommendation of cannabis in California is lawful. Even with a cursory review of the literature, cannabis, by all tests, is a safe, non-toxic drug. We are not talking about a drug that is dangerous. The government has lied to us about the use of cannabis and its dangers for the last 32 years. Again, a cursory review of the literature will bear that out. 1,700 patients die in this year every year from taking NSAIDs. I'm not familiar with that drug, whatever it is. NSDAIS. NSAIDs. NSAIDs. There has never been a death associated with cannabis. Given this information, the conduct of the MBC, the medical board, that leads to sanctions of MDs is purely political, and that's wrong. When you mention that 9 investigations is a small number, you must consider the effect of those investigations on the rest of the physicians in California. The sanction of even one physician will have a dramatic impact on the practices of all others. And I'll interrupt this article to say my own physician, Steve Halpern, refuses to even consider recommending marijuana for anything other than the 4 life-threatening conditions because of this his fear that he will be hauled into court or have his medical credentials taken away. So it has effects in Santa Cruz. Dale Schaefer, with his wife Molly Fry in attendance, said this at the medical board that's considering sanctioning the 9 physicians who are providing 50% of the medical marijuana recommendations and letters. I'm an attorney and I represent between 7 and 8,000 patients. I met with Mr. Thornton in 2000, that's the investigator, and provided him with the protocols of the office that we were running, how patients were evaluated, the documentation that we kept. We were informed that if there were a good faith prior exam and medical indication, the physicians would be left alone. We have found out through the Freedom of Information Act that the law enforcement tail is wagging the medical board dog. As soon as this law passed in 1996, our Attorney General, Dan Lundgren, met with Barry McCaffrey in Washington and put together a strategy to scare the bejesus out of any doctor who dared to do this. We have a federal restraining order now in place, the Conant versus Walters decision, that permanently enjoins the federal government from going after DEA registration. It's closing the barn door after the horse is gone. As soon as you threaten the physician's DEA registration or their medical practice, they don't want to touch this. What would the medical board do if a police officer called to complain that somebody with a bottle of Vicodin didn't have enough pain to qualify for a Vicodin prescription? Would they investigate? But that's exactly what law enforcement is doing. They're playing doctor. If you don't think you're sick enough or they're angry that you weren't prosecuted successfully, they forward a complaint to the medical board. I think that's the genesis of every one of these investigations so far. We do not have any reasonable protocols for doctors to use if a person comes in and says, I've got X, Y, or Z disease, I want to use marijuana. These investigations have sent a chilling effect out, just like when Barry McCaffrey pointed to Todd McAree and said, how dare you put depression on this list, or post-traumatic stress disorder. My wife has breast cancer. Her oncologist left the room when we asked if she could smoke pot. He would give her a prescription for Marinol, and that's what kept us from being prosecuted, but he wouldn't say, you can use marijuana. And if you find a doctor who says, go ahead and smoke marijuana, they don't know what to tell you next. What do you do? How much? 2.5 milligrams is supposed to be the beginning of a therapeutic dose. Doctors need to be taught about cannabinoids and about vaporization, about the old tinctures that doctors used to use that you drop under your tongue. Doctors are afraid. They're looking to the medical board for assistance, and all they run into is law enforcement, the tail wagging the dog. We need a moratorium on these investigations until protocols are developed and doctors are educated in what the protocols are, and then hold them to task if they violate these protocols. Ryan Landers said at this board meeting on May 8th, I've had full-blown AIDS for 7 years. The only way I can take my HIV cocktail and not throw up or control the cramping pain and the lack of eating pain, there's so many different kinds of pain you get combined, plus the complete lack of hunger. Without marijuana, I couldn't take these medications. I don't get high, I don't get a buzz at all, and neither do most patients who use it regularly. Those feelings wear off. You don't get that. I've tried many different prescriptions, Marinol, Compazine, you name it. They didn't work for me, and I don't take them anymore. The presence of marijuana on Schedule 1 makes no sense, given that Marinol is an extract of the plant's main active ingredient. Why would you replicate a chemical of a plant if it has no medical value whatsoever? The patients that are receiving marijuana from the federal government all continue to receive it, and Dr. Ethan Russo's study shows that it hasn't had any long-term negative effects. It's helping them, and they should continue the treatment. I worked on the law that got the research program going here in California, but I couldn't sign up for a study under the program because the quality of the marijuana I would have had to use is so inferior to what's available, only 2 to 4% THC. I visit an HIV specialist, but I don't ask her to do my recommendations because I don't want her jeopardized. We need her drastically. I have another doctor whom I also see regularly do it. I urge you, I beg you, to encourage your colleagues to stand up and write recommendations and not force patients to have to search for a doctor who also has to be in fear. The reason why certain doctors write more recommendations is that we have to go to them. They're the only ones who will look at our situations and deal with it. The doctors we've been seeing on a continuous basis are fearful. Jay Bergstrom writes, I just went around with melanoma, and I made my doctor go absolutely white and run from the room when I tried to get a recommendation. The fear is just palpable. And from then on, you have to wonder if you're getting second-level care because they're scared when you come into the office. I can feel the change ever since I asked for a recommendation. Frank Lucido, M.D., handed the committee members a detailed prepared statement plus a statement from Behrman, then read them as key points. He called attention to the recent resolution by the California Medical Association urging the board to issue clear practical practice standards for physicians who approve marijuana use by their patients. Unfortunately, Lucido observed, there is still no medical or legal definition of good faith exam. Lucido called on the board to be more discerning in deciding which complaints to investigate and from what source. Top priority suggested should be given to complaints from a patient, family member, caregiver. Justification for using marijuana as medicine. A lie, contradicted by the federal government's own Institute of Medicine report. His bottom line advice to the board, drop all ongoing investigations to date of physicians based on misunderstanding of the law and or the benefits of medical cannabis, especially those based only on law enforcement complaints in light of their clear misinformation. Stephen Shearer, director of Americans for Safe Access, told the board, in my office, we receive at least 5 phone calls a day from seriously ill Californians who have gone to their doctors and asked if this was a possibility for their treatment. About 75% of the doctors say they won't recommend cannabis out of fear from the medical board and the federal government. 25% don't understand the medicinal value of cannabis. The doctors being investigated, said Shearer, are the outspoken ones. People are being attacked for their bravery, is how she summed up the situation. And this is Fred Gardner's cannabinoid notes in the Anderson Valley Advertiser. Actually, it's cannabinoid, cannabinotes. And you can pick it up, as I said, at the Book Loft, which is right next to the old VO Theater at Soquel and Seabright. You can also get it at the Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown. While you're in there, ask them if they'll let in poor Robert Norris, who's waiting at the door but doesn't want to get arrested by walking into the bookshop. And you can also pick it up out at the Capitola Book Cafe, though there are very few copies there, maybe a few. That's in the shopping center at 41st and Capitola Road. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Looks like we have a phone call here. I think we'll actually be able to hear this one. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Good. The worship of the dead. Sounds like you and Phil Oakes are calling in together, huh?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about. It sounds better, doesn't it?
Huh. So are you playing him over there or hearing him on the radio?
I'm hearing him No, he's on the radio. You got him going. There.
It's finally stopped. It's interesting. I don't know why that's been... So that was playing throughout the entire thing I was reading?
No, it just started.
Very strange.
It started when you picked up the phone.
Huh.
Anyway, I was wondering, you're talking about the medical marijuana. There was a request for some $10 million or $10 billion or something like that in funds by, I'm not sure, was it the feds, to investigate specifically medical marijuana, doctors, caregivers, and patients, and they lost the money. They didn't get the money, but I never did figure out exactly what legislature was asking for it and didn't get it. Do you know who that was? Hello?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I know that Becky Johnson's been doing some research on marijuana law action recently in different states. Maybe if she's listening in, she might have the answer to that. One thing to do, are you have access to a computer?
What kind of, yeah, you know, there's a library and stuff like that.
You've got distant access. How are you doing, by the way? I recognize your voice, Doug. You've been recovering from a near-death experience.
Right. You know, I get so much better every day, man. I just realized how sick I really was. It was like, whoa, I was really sick.
Are you you're out of the hospital and out of the care situation now? How are you?
Yeah, well, I still have to go to doctors. And they're still checking up on me, but all my all my holes in my body had closed up and everything. Yeah, I had to remove part of one of my lungs and stuff like that. But that's all history. And
you still smoking marijuana there, Doug?
Yes, but, you know, if I could, there's a deal. My particular recommendation has expired. Of course, that wasn't written in the original law, as we know. But to get into one of the clubs, you got to have a recommendation that is less than a year old. And that's where I can get tinctures and stuff. You can't get tinctures, you know, from people on the streets, and they don't have, the brownies and the cookies and the candy and stuff that they
have. What club are you using, Doug?
I use a couple of clubs in town. Well, three of them here in town. There's the one that, is in that lawyer's office on Maple.
Well, I know that the clubs in town have been driven out of business. There's only one thing operating, and that's Wham. And that's got a huge waiting list, right?
Yeah, I've been on the Wham's waiting list for about 6-7 years, man. So that don't work for me.
So when was the last time you were able to use a club in town?
No. There was the Kate had the one, and then there was one that kind of split off from that was a mobile unit for a while.
Because I haven't heard of a club.
It's been a couple of years.
It's been a couple of years. Because I've been very critical since 2000. The city's zoning laws have killed all the other clubs but Wham. And I guess you have the mobile MedX, which is a very, very small group, like 20 or 30 or 40 people.
Oh, well, there's MedX and all that, but see, you still have to have a... recommendation that's less than a year old.
Yeah, Rachel, I was just sort of pointing out that there is no way, with or without a recommendation, to get into a club in the Santa Cruz area because of the city council's refusal to change the bad zoning laws that Rotkin and Fitzmaurice passed way back in the summer of 2000.
Well, it's not just the zoning laws. It's public opinion, the NIMBY stuff. What you say is true. They get on nationwide TV saying how cool they are about it. But, we'll come to town. They're going to arrest you, and they're going to put you in jail. They're going to prosecute you. And then if you go try to find a club, you're not going to find one. You're going to have to go to San Francisco or Oakland. So it's all BS.
Well, wait a minute. Now, I disagree with you, Doug. We had clubs galore, even when it was illegal.
Right.
And we had clubs galore after it was legalized until the city council passed its law in the summer of 2000, and then the clubs were destroyed. I mean, I just disagree with you on that.
Well, there was a guy that was complaining on that. There was a retired police officer or something like that was complaining.
He was complaining under the 2000 law that the city council passed. And that's what enabled a complaint of a police officer and a DA to close down a club. Before
has it been that long?
They couldn't do that before. See, that's the point.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you on that point.
Right.
But there's places out on the west side here that people ought to be able to put up a place. They're outside of the zoning laws. I don't know why they haven't done it. Personally, and I think it's just NIMBY. I think they still get hassled. You still got the DEA dropping in.
Well, you always had that, and you had clubs before. The point is, because of these new laws, you do not have that ability now. I mean, as far as
what they need to do is put in a protective law, a law that protects.
Or just remove the zoning law, and the clubs would return. It seems to me that they have made it impossible for the clubs to be here in this town, and
there
I don't blame the
certain states.
What?
To be certain spots. No, I'm just like 2 blocks away from where they can be legally with the zoning laws.
Where is that?
All over the west side over here in this industrial park.
I guess what I need to do is we need to. My understanding for people like Kate Wells is that those aren't a possibility. That they can't do that in those areas, for various reasons. But that they've tried twice to open a club and they couldn't open it up. It was closed down, and it wasn't because of a complaint. It was because of complaints using the zoning laws.
Mm-hmm. I don't have any. I haven't talked to Kate personally. Why can't you do it here? Why can't you do it there?
Those are important questions, and I'll try to raise those questions.
But
anyway,
how's she doing, by the way?
She's all right. She's no longer. Kate Wells is an attorney who was also helped with the two cannabis clubs. I think she co-founded one of them and was attorney for the other one. She... She's got a lot, got a number of health problems, and she's no longer taking new cases, but she's still kind of finishing up the one she had. She's working on a website where she can, where you can get some kind of legal help, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she, of course, she does reports for free radio. We may be able to get her on the line today. It's possible.
Okay. Well, maybe she knows about that legislation that just did not pass. They were asking for the money, and they didn't get it. And they specifically were going to use all that drug money, you know, to fight medical marijuana patients and, marijuana patients,
yeah,
caregivers, and doctors.
I think I remember something vaguely about that, but I don't. You're talking about a federal appropriation of some kind, or?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if it's federal or state, but I think it was federal.
Yeah, I'm...
But $10 million doesn't seem like enough money for federal, and that's what I thought I heard.
Not sure.
And then I also heard something that there's a possibility that they may lose camp money, you know, money from camp, all the states that have passed a medical marijuana law, too. I've heard vague things with no back and forth or anyone I could discuss it with. Yeah, that'd be a good thing for Kate or your producer to call in about and everything. And I'll let y'all get back on the deal. But anyway, those are a couple of things I wanted to know. Also, you wanted to know who that guy was. He was found north across from where Camp Paradise was, the Water Street Bridge, the man that was found dead.
Right, right. That's what I heard.
Yeah, it was the old Water Street Bridge. It's not Water Street.
Did you hear anything about that other than what you read in the paper? Did you hear anything, any scuttlebutt?
I didn't read anything in the paper. I heard about it yesterday. Some people that had been down there told me he was naked from the waist down and found dead, and they ran everybody off, and no one really knew what for, and they weren't answering any questions. That's what was, and he was just the bridge that goes over the river, Highway 1.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like north, just across the street from where Camp Paradise, or across the river from Camp Paradise.
Mm.
You know, so there's no telling, you know, if he was robbed or beaten, and I guess he was, it says he was slain, I think, in the paper now, right?
What's that? Yeah, his name.
He was slain in the paper, they said, huh?
He was slain, but there's no. I don't think it gives his name. It gives the name of the suspect. I don't think it gives the name of his. Who he was.
Oh, they got the name of the suspect. Well, I'm
Kenneth Harris, a 32-year-old homeless man. I don't know. They know he's 32, but they don't know. No, they do have his name. I'm sorry. Jody Hunter is the name of the man who was
killed.
Yeah, you don't know
And who's the suspect?
And the suspect is Kenneth Harris. And he's known as J.D., Jody Hunter, supposedly.
Yeah, that's why I heard J.D. I heard J.D.
Sounds familiar, but I'm still not kind of placing the name with the face. Well, listen, thanks for your call. Anything else you want to say, Doug?
No, I guess that's about it. If anyone can come up with that, you know, give you a call, and I'll hear it on the radio.
Yeah, if you hear anything about this, cutting off appropriations to states that have medical marijuana programs.
Right, all that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank
Take
you.
It easy, man. Keep doing what you're doing.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And phone lines are open. We've got about an hour left. 427-3772 is our number here. And I'm kind of thumbing my way through the city council agenda to see what looks interesting. It's a Tuesday city council meeting coming up the day after tomorrow. Monday meeting, if you're interested, of the supervisor, Marty Wormout, will be at 5 o'clock at the former Java House, now the Union Street Cafe, if you want to talk to her. I guess coming back on the agenda fairly soon is this medical marijuana ID card deal, in case you're interested in checking that out. Let's see what we got coming up on the agenda. The interesting agenda, there's a 3 o'clock session and a 7 o'clock session, and there's a legal session at 1 and a redevelopment agency session at 5, or whenever the 3 o'clock session ends on Tuesday. Now, what do we got on the 3 o'clock session, the consent agenda? Item number 3 has my claim for over $25,000 for an arrest. I was arrested, as regular listeners know, by council member Ed Porter for tape recording a city council subcommittee meeting, an ad hoc subcommittee of the city council meeting with the downtown commission's members on the issue of downtown issues back in November. And I filed a claim on that, which there's no question it's going to be rejected. And
because the purpose of that is, of course, to change their policies and to get some kind of damages for what they did, and in so doing, to encourage them to stop doing that in the future to other people. I haven't heard of another arrest for tape recording. I know a lot of us showed up at tape recorders at the next meeting of that particular Downtown Issues working group, but the response of the city council was to hold no more meetings other than the meeting after that, and to have all their meetings secret staff meetings, and that's what they've done for the last 6 months. That's what this fence off the planter at Costa Brava is coming out of, closed meetings, which we only know about because Dan White got wind of it and said something about it in the paper. Let's see what we got here. We have a sole source purchase of a recycling truck for $192,000. Sole source always draws my interest. That's item 10 on the agenda. When you go online, you can sometimes get documents, so-called agenda reports, and you can look them over and see if you're interested in seeing what's going on at the city council. Maybe they're giving their justification for why they do a $192,000 purchase of a vehicle without putting it out for bid, which is the usual approach. And I just sort of notice it as I go through. Many times you don't see the amount of money involved here in... Looks like we have a phone call. We'll interrupt this analysis of the city council budget, I should say city council agenda, to catch this call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Andrea. I was at the Compassion Flower Inn.
Yes.
I was listening with much interest to your program this morning.
Uh-huh.
And in regards to the previous caller who talked about that anti-drug money that the states get from the federal government permitting... that they're going to withdraw, the federal government is going to withdraw money mm-hmm. From the states that have medical marijuana initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
There was an article in the newspaper on May the 22nd, and in the Sentinel, right. And it did say that the House Republicans are pressing for legalization legislation that would strip federal anti-drug money from local police in states that have passed medical marijuana laws.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say I pretty much support that because, we don't want them to enforce drug laws anyway.
That's true. That's very true, although, of course, that will put pressure on other states to... Who are concerned with stopping the bad drug users?
Yeah.
To not pass medical marijuana laws, though apparently that movement is completely independent of, to some extent, of this kind. Well, mm-hmm. It's hard to think it's independent of these pressures, but yeah.
Yeah,
I kind of agree with you.
Mm-hmm. However, it's also going to change public opinion away from medical marijuana and saying, "Gosh, we do need." Drug laws to be enforced, and it's going to weaken the medical marijuana movement, I think, overall, if this is passed.
Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be another argument medical marijuana law changers are going to have to face, which is to say the problem is sufficiently intense that you may lose your drug money, but it's more important for you to stop wasting your resources going after medical marijuana people, and it might encourage people to fight the drug the drug prohibition generally
mm-hmm.
instead of trying to say, well, here's this minority of people who need medical marijuana and use them as the sort of spearhead and the wedge, which hasn't really worked. I mean, it's worked to some extent in protecting them a little bit, but it hasn't worked in terms of decriminalizing marijuana.
Right, not at all. Yeah, we need to emphasize more serious problems that we have and put, the limited amount of money that we have for, law enforcement. Now, I guess all of the budgets are being cut all over the country. This would be a good opportunity, a good segue in which to say, all right, we have marijuana, and that's far more or far less harmful than some of the other drugs, including alcohol.
Oh,
I mean, we run this little bed and breakfast down here, and the problems that we have nightly from the drunkards out there on the street is just incredible.
Well, you're bed, bud, and breakfast, right?
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you make it bed booze and breakfast?
Well, we already have that, yeah. That just comes built in just from the neighborhood.
Gotcha.
You know, something that probably most of the people don't know about is that the sheriff received $250,000 for his marijuana suppression program.
When was this?
This last Tuesday. The Board of Supervisors. I was the only one present. Theodora had gone up to Strawberry, and there was not enough time to get the word out.
Did Valerie Corral stand up and say no?
No, she wasn't there. I don't even know if she knew about it. Because, you know, it wasn't something that was really well publicized. It was a slam dunk again for the sheriff for the umpteenth year that he's received this amount of money.
Is this the camp grant?
It's the camp grant. It's the traditional, you know, what they used to call the camp grant, the Campaign Against Marijuana Planting grant for seeking out the marijuana by, you know, using helicopters.
And we know that marijuana plants are potential vegetable terrorists, right?
Absolutely.
Did Marty vote against this?
Well, Marty was the only one that voted against it.
Did she speak against it?
She spoke just briefly, and basically what she said was she had nothing really, she's not really opposed to what the sheriff has been doing with respect to marijuana enforcement, that she thinks that he's doing a good job. And that this was her vote no on the grant was no reflection on how the sheriff is doing, because she thinks that the sheriff is doing a fairly good job.
Kissy. Did the sheriff justify?
Well, the sheriff supported her, you know, in the last election. You know, he came out and supported her despite the fact that she opposes the grant every year. And also, you know, when the budget comes up, his budget comes up, she... you know, she criticizes certain aspects of the budget. She said that she voted against the camp grant or the marijuana suppression grant for the reason that she thinks that the drug war is a failed policy.
It would seem to me that the relevant question to ask, which Marty Miller probably didn't ask, is what do you need the money for? You know, what are you using it for? What did you use it for last year? Can you please describe for us how it went, where it went?
Well, they do have, I mean, I've got this thing that's about three-quarters of inch thick. It's it does say what he does with the money. And, you know, basically, it's, you know, to fly the helicopters. It's also to pay informants from tips and so forth, and keep to hire two full-time police officers, specifically who only are there to investigate marijuana-related cases.
It sounds like what we call narcs, and it sounds like the worst kind of narcs.
Mm-hmm.
Narcs who go after something that is essentially. Although I suppose anything would be abused, a harmless drug, a harmless plant, a harmless herb, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Did you say anything about this? Or?
I was the only person that spoke.
What did you say?
I could use the same speech I used last year and the year before and the year before. There's nothing that really has changed. I think that we should... reject the grant based on the fact that, like Marty says, it's a failed policy. And number two, it is a drug which, in at least Santa Cruz, is pretty much accepted by many, many people. Probably the majority of people, if we had a vote today, would vote to legalize cannabis, I would say. In the county.
You know, I mean, it seems to me maybe what people need to... If I had heard about this, I would have mentioned it on the air, but I don't follow the supervisor's agendas very closely. By the way, if you hear of anything like this coming up, Andrea, let me know in the future. But
I heard about this 2 days before the hearing.
And yet you were meeting with Marty Wernhout.
I met with Marty on Monday, and she told me that she was going to vote against it.
But she didn't tell you in advance it was coming up.
She didn't tell me, but Susan Morello over at the county called me up and told me about it. And I went over there and got all the documents that went along with it.
Good for you.
And I looked it over. It's pretty much the same as it is all the time. The point is that what the sheriff's arguments are is that if they don't get this money, they're going to have to take money away from more popular programs, for example, the domestic violence program, you know, to help. Do they have to take money away from drug enforcement and put it into other programs, and therefore the drug enforcement is not going to be there? And people are still concerned about...
seems to me, though, Andrea, that argument, of course, is... I mean, they're either then... This is money for marijuana eradication, is it not?
Marijuana eradication, they also investigate the indoor grows as well.
Right.
It's the whole program. They look at PG&E records and, you know, they do the whole investigative report.
It seems to me this is a perfect opportunity, if somebody thinks of it next year, to demand of the sheriff just how fucking much they're spending on marijuana enforcement in this county.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe comparing it with how much marijuana and money is being spent in other counties, what exactly, who they've busted, you know, in terms of the specific number of people, what those people were doing with their marijuana, what the quantities were, although, frankly, that doesn't interest me a hell of a lot. But to get a real picture, I mean, because you're saying, well, if they cut off the money for this, it doesn't mean they have to cut the money out of domestic violence. It means they have to stop enforcing this crap.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means, it seems to me, unless they can say, oh, we're going to be sued for not enforcing existing laws.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in Berkeley police have made it, supposedly, although there's some doubts about this, since 1979, the lowest priority. There's no reason why the county of Santa Cruz couldn't do the same thing, is there?
Well, I'm very much in favor of, low enforcement. I even mentioned that in my my little speech there before the board. I think that it could be, when you have a smaller budget, you have to cut certain things out. And so marijuana is one of the least of our problems in this county. And, you know, heroin, methamphetamines, and alcoholism is, like, by far, far more serious as far as drugs are concerned.
And what I'm saying is that this argument that you need to take camp money to protect other programs is crap. It is a false argument.
Mm-hmm.
You only need to take the camp money if you are insisting on going after people who are growing and selling and buying marijuana. And it seems to me that he should be forced to make the argument, this is why we're going to go after those people, and this is why we need to. And for him to throw in domestic violence is a complete canard and red herring.
Mm-hmm.
Really pisses me off.
Yeah, well, yeah, and also he says that through the marijuana investigations, they sometimes find people with heroin and methamphetamine labs and people selling heroin. They find these kind of rings as a result of investigating and, you know, of course, there's not a great deal of public support for these hard drugs. And that, I think, people recognize is one of our bigger problems.
Well, let him then show the stats on how much that has happened. I mean, you can investigate, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad you were there to challenge it. I wish I'd known about it. I might well have come down, too. I know that you were also considering other issues, like this medical marijuana ID card that was... Did you come back on the 20th, and I guess was postponed?
That was postponed until June the 11th, and June the 10th. It's going to be at the discussed at the Board of Supervisors at 9 o'clock on June 10th. The ID program, I asked Marty about that. Marty's the one that's introducing that, and she's dead firm, you know, that it's the best thing to happen for the county, for the medical marijuana patients.
Have you been involved in any way in the discussions of that with people like Ramakalsa supposedly developing it?
Yeah, well, we're talking with Kate Wells and with Anita Henry and Theodora Carey and myself, people who are longtime activists, have been talking about it. I haven't been talking about it with the public health people.
I know that we asked if you could be a part of those meetings. And she said, no, they're closed meetings.
Yeah, right. We haven't been invited to those meetings.
But have the corrals been invited to any of them?
Oh, I'm sure they're involved in the meetings, right, because they're the ones that really, I think, went to Marty in the first place and said, this is a good thing, this ID program, countywide ID program.
So the service providers who provided 80% of the marijuana in Santa Cruz to medical patients are not invited, and the corrals who provide... the only legal, essentially legal providers in the county, or in the city, I should say, in the city and the county, are invited.
Yeah, I want to just say that I'm not a provider and never have been a provider. Of I'm just an activist for medical marijuana. But that's probably true. There's no, like you mentioned before, there's no other dispensary in Santa Cruz. So
can I ask you about that question, Andrea, that I guess Doug brought up a moment ago, which is, why can't somebody set up under the current zoning laws a marijuana club, I don't know, out in an industrial area or something? Is that possible?
It's possible because, as he mentioned, there is an area that is approved that is in industrial areas, and also the Mission Street corridor and the Soquel Street, Soquel Avenue, up to... you know, about Brantza 40 or someplace, is like an approved area of that you can have a dispensary. So you can have dispensaries along those two areas, but, you know, there hasn't been a lot of people that have been forthcoming that are willing to do that.
And is that because of what Doug suggested, is a federal crackdown or, you know, a growing, some sort of right-wing antipathy to marijuana that's been secretly growing, unknown to me? Fundamentalist revival, I don't know, or is it, I mean, I've always thought, and you're telling me now that it's not, that perhaps I was wrong, is that once the zoning laws were passed in 2000, which closed two clubs, or one club that attempted to move and just deterred a second one from moving in, what I heard from Kate Wells and others was there really was no place to put in medical marijuana clubs.
Well, you know, it is so restrictive that it makes it very difficult to find a place. And then when you find a place, is the landlord going to rent to you because, well, you know, are the feds going to come right in and, pounce on them like they did with Wynn? And that's, I think, what we're all kind of waiting to see this summer, is if the DEA is going to come down on the remaining clubs and dispensary in Northern California, because there's a number of them. There's like probably in the Bay Area, there's over 40 or 50 clubs, Oakland, Berkeley, Hayward, San Francisco. And everything that we've heard is that there's going to be more raids this spring and summer. Who wants to start up a club when and go through that investment, the initial investment? That's what really broke the cannabis pharmaceutical is that when they did find another location, the city councilman, what was his name, Fernandez, I think?
Yeah.
Hernandez. He said that there was going to be a charter school that was going to start down the street from Barrios Unidos,
mm-hmm.
Just down the street from where they were starting the club. And they had already put down a first and last month's rent. They had over $10,000 invested just in the security deposits and the first month rent. And they, you know, had another $10,000 worth of interior, you know, modifications to make to the building, and then they had already started that, and then this Barrios Unidos thing came up, and they had to stop the construction project and back out of the lease, and they lost a lot of money, and so this is what happened in that case,
mm-hmm.
And it is so difficult because, you know, 500 feet is a long distance. I mean, we couldn't start one here, even if it was zoned, because of the Loudoun Nelson, which has a little daycare center, just you know, and that's less than 500 feet away from our inn. So it's just very difficult in Santa Cruz to find a place that meets all the requirements and where a landlord is willing to stick his or her neck out of the line to rent to you, you know, and take mm-hmm. that chance.
Andrea, have you talked to any council members in the last year or two about this issue and tried to indicate to them that you would like to see a change in the zoning laws? And
I talked with Rotkin right before the election.
Mm-hmm.
Was a little fundraiser, and I said, would you be willing to work with us you know, this year in changing some of those restrictive zoning laws? I remember distinctly at the meeting where they passed the zoning the ordinance here in Santa Cruz. He was on the city council when that was passed, and he says this is not something that's set in concrete. This is just a beginning. That we can change these laws, and he told me that he would be willing to modify and change them. But we have to do that. That's one thing that we have to get rallied up and do. You know, Robert, there were other people that knew about this hearing on Tuesday and never bothered to show up. We made the announcement when Eric Schlosser was giving his little talk at Bookshop Santa Cruz on Friday night to a crowd of about 150 people who were interested in hearing his comments about the new book that he wrote, Reefer Madness, and nobody shows up. It's just this whole apathy that seems to exist now, this kind of malaise in this city. Maybe it's all over the place because people pretty much, I think, do feel that things are hopeless. And we don't, I can't do it. I'm not going to do it all by myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go to all these hearings. I'm not going to meet with Mike Rodkin and with all these city council members by myself. I mean, we'll get nowhere because it's just, they listen to the numbers. And when we got 350 people out to the Board of Supervisors meeting 10 years ago for a camp grant, we got some results. We got something in place where the sheriff can't fly below 1,000 feet over a home. He can't fly over the Route 9 corridor. He can't go over the same territories twice in the helicopters. He has to report to the board every year about his investigations, and he has to do all these things. We got results, and those are still in place. And we ask that question every year to the board: is the sheriff willing to abide by these rules?
Have you scrutinized those results each year? I mean, this last year, have you seen the report? Are you satisfied that the sheriff is meeting those conditions, or do you have any sense of that?
Well, he did 58 marijuana-related cases this year.
Mm-hmm.
14 of those cases were medical necessity cases, where medical marijuana recommendations were, and the people said that they were medical marijuana patients.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a copy here of the 14 cases, and they're it's very sketchy, very, very sketchy, the way he wrote it. Here's the first case here. Like, let me read that to you. This investigation resulted in the issuance of a search warrant. Upon service, numerous items of evidence were seized. Two suspects were arrested for cultivating marijuana and possessing marijuana for sale. One of the defendants did possess a medical marijuana recommendation. However, based upon a very thorough investigation, including interviews and detailed review of the evidence seized, both suspects pleaded guilty to cultivation of marijuana. I mean, it doesn't really tell us too much about, and all these cases are kind of similar in that some of them were acquitted, some of them had other drugs, including psilocybin and ecstasy that, in addition to the medical marijuana as part of the case. These cases are all very complicated, and it's hard to do a little small brief paragraph describing everything that happened.
I'm glad you have these records in there.
But he's doing a better job, let's put it this way, than probably some sheriff in another county. I have to say that Sheriff Tracy is recognizes the state law, and he is trying to respect the rights of the patients to show him a recommendation. But he's very, very, he wants everything, really buttoned down.
He doesn't like the idea of guidelines. I know we had him on Free Radio. Did you hear about that? He was on Free Radio last week.
Sheriff Tracy?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
Oh, wonderful. What did he say?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't know he was coming in until, he didn't come in, he phoned in, but I didn't know that was happening until the show started. And so I was caught with my pants not just down, but completely off. And also, he didn't know he was calling my show. This is my co-host, who has a somewhat slippery side to him. But he wanted Tracy to, phone in. So my co-host did most of the questions. When Tracy heard it was me, he got very nervous and, started, I don't want to talk about, I didn't agree to answer your questions, blah, blah, blah. So I did the softball thing, for which I was taken taken to court, so to speak, later on, taken to account, you know, because I didn't ask him about Sergeant Deverell, I didn't ask him about abuse of power, I did ask him about medical marijuana and about the guidelines, and he acknowledged that he had opposed, first he said that the caretakers had opposed the guidelines, and I said no, so I understand that only one caretaker opposed the guidelines. The other ones, and the other people involved in this movement, got to the meeting an hour after the issue had been decided because they were missing, it was moved up at the request of Valerie Corral. And the whole issue of the guidelines, they weren't even able to have input into it in that way. And then Tracy said, well, I acknowledge that I oppose guidelines. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're a good idea. He didn't go into why, particularly, or at least I don't remember what he said about that.
Mm-hmm.
But we got a few, maybe you should listen to the tape you've talked to Tracy yourself, though.
We have talked with him about the guidelines, and it's interesting that a couple years ago he was not opposed to guidelines. He did say that he would be receptive to talking and working on guidelines for the county, which would establish a plant number and our canopy for our growing area that you could grow a certain number of plants and a quantity amount that patients can feel comfortable with. Right now the way it is, it's just like it's a crapshoot. It's they establish what the recommended number of marijuana plants are. I mean, the second case that I'm looking at here, it says, this investigation resulted in an issuance of a search warrant. Upon service, 52 marijuana plants were located under cultivation. The deputies conducted a thorough investigation, including an interview with a suspect and review of his medical recommendation, which was expired. This particular document indicated that 10 plants were recommended. I don't know. Maybe doctors do say that the 10 plants are recommended and so forth. But, I think that the Sheriff Tracy wants to play doctor here. You know, it's like you had read that article that Gardner wrote and mm-hmm. said, where is there, do the police ever question whether a person is in sufficient pain to possess that much Vicodin, I mean, you just never hear of cops questioning the prescription medicine that people receive. Yet when they have marijuana, a doctor, they'll say, "Oh no, you can only have 10 plants or 6 plants," and this is preposterous. This is really ridiculous that this kind of a thing exists. And I think that universally, I mean, everybody that I've talked with that is a medical marijuana patient and or a caregiver would love to see some guidelines so that they could know how much marijuana they could grow safely and or possess.
I would imagine. I let me ask you a couple other quick questions here, but then I got to rush on with the last 20 minutes of this exciting show we're doing here. And I'm really glad you're calling in, Andrea, because you've got a lot of personal experience and documentation from Tracy, I might add. Which are you willing to make that public and available?
It's right here. It's right here in front of me. Looking at it.
Great. Well,
of course.
Give me a copy, and I'll try and have it available for Huff members.
It's public information. It's very interesting reading.
I mean, I'm also wondering if we have any documentation that his helicopters have been flying in the right places, and are there complaints against the
sheriff's office? There have been no complaints. Actually, last year there were no complaints. They've actually reduced the number of hours that they've flown from 150 10 years ago, and then when 300 people showed up at the Board of Supervisors, we got that reduced down to about 40.
So they have sort of a gentler, kindler fascism, and everybody goes home.
Exactly. And that's exactly the point that I think should be made, is that people feel now with Proposition 215 and that, there's not all of this, real super fascism that with respect to marijuana, that we're all feeling good now. We're all staying in our homes and, staying out. Medicated.
Right. And if we aren't, they'll send needles on wheels to our door. Thank you, SB 1421. What about, we talked a bit about a forum, where the care providers got together and maybe getting, Ed Rosenthal involved in this. And apparently book signings, was this a book signing that you mentioned this thing out on Friday, have a pretty big turnout?
Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation, and stayed here at the inn, actually. He's award-winning journalist. The Fast Food Nation was a bestseller. Just came out with a new book. He just came out with Reefer Madness, which is at the bookstore.
That's the novelization of the movie Reefer Madness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, this is Reefer Madness. Government's Reefer Madness, we're doing. Not when you smoke pot. Then.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very good book. I mean, I have a copy of it signed here by him. Yeah, there were 150 people maybe at the Bookshop Santa Cruz.
Do you think such people would show up at a forum? Could we do something sexy and get people to come to a forum like that?
I didn't recognize most of the people who were there. I imagine a lot of university students. There were a few activists in the crowd, but I looked over the whole crowd, and except for Theodora and a few others, you know, I didn't recognize anybody.
Has this radio show's discussions of marijuana and the fight against drug prohibition gotten anybody to call you up and to offer to help with the forum?
No. That's the problem, is that I ain't going to do it myself, and it's not going to work unless more people become involved. And I think basically what we need is a lot of new people, younger people maybe, people who are willing to really put the time in to do this. Because Theodora is burned out. We've been on the front lines now for, almost 14 years, mm-hmm. And this is something where we've gotten some things. We got Proposition 215. We did very successful Measure A back in 1992, which was a strong response by the people who live in the county to support medical marijuana. We have a WHAM organization, and that's a very outspoken organization. Also, who are doing a lot of good things like this for their patients, basically, I think people are they're pretty placated.
I think more important, you got large clubs established, at least until Rodkin and Fitzmaurice came along with Valerie Corral in tow, or vice versa, and destroyed the clubs in the spring and summer of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And the clubs that were serving people.